Hi.
Thank you for sticking around. I think I wanted to start by very quickly making what I think is a slightly sacrilegious confession in light of the day's activities, which is that I've always been profoundly ambivalent about David Foster Wallace's writing, extremely ambivalent. I think it's in part because of the way I was introduced to it. So the very first time I heard about David Foster Wallace was when I was an undergraduate student. I was sort of talking idly over coffee with some other undergraduates. And this guy who was really, really cool in a kind of self-consciously and always sort of self-declaring way, extraordinarily baggy clothes as we wore in the 1990s. We're talking about our dissertations. I wasn't writing one because I was concerned with other things at that point in my life. But he was, and he said, I'm writing my dissertation. I'm working on it. So it's really quite hard. And I said, what are you writing on? He said, this is a postmodern art novelist named David Foster Wallace. Probably never heard of him. And he went on to describe Infinite Jest and how great it was and how challenging it was and so on. And I felt like I had to read this book to be as cool as this guy who was so sort of constantly broadcasting his coolness. And I read the book and it just didn't move me. And then I went on to read other David Foster Wallace works over the course of the next 10 years or so. I was similarly unmoved. And that was because, for me, the thing that I really love about literature, the works that I read for pleasure rather than those that I teach particularly, is that sort of pre-linguistic kind of shiver that the best literature, I think, can inspire in you, where it's not about what's on the page, but it's on what's on the page summons. And I always thought that David Foster Wallace didn't have that. Everything in his work was post-linguistic. Everything was calling attention to itself. And everything was written for the certain kind of hyper-educated, relatively self-confident, maybe a little bit smug sort of male that I thought myself to be, but wished that I wasn't. But then I discovered this collection, Consider the Lobster. And this is what I want to read from an essay from this to you today. This essay called Joseph France, Dostoevsky, which you've probably encountered yourselves, was the essay that made me rethink my feelings about David Foster Wallace. And I think it did so for reasons that I think should be self-evident in light of the essay's content. So this is what I will read to you. Now, I have no idea how people have been dealing with digressions during the course of the day, and I've tried different things, like putting on strange different voices, but I don't do those very well. So if I come to a footnote, I'll just say footnote. And I won't say end footnote, I think it should be obvious when I go back. And if I'm doing a footnote within a footnote, I will raise my hand, so you know we're still in footnote territory, but just deeper. So, that's it. Joseph Franks Dostoevsky. Just reposition this. Okay. Have a prolegomenous look at two quotations. The first is from Edward Dahlberg, a Dostoevsky grade curmudgeon, if ever in English there was one. Quote, "The citizen secures himself against genius by icon worship. By the touch of Circe's wand, the divine troublemakers are translated into porcine embroidery." The second is from Turgenev's Fathers and Sons, and this is a passage of dialogue. "At the present time, negation is the most useful of all, and we deny everything? Everything. What, not only art and poetry, but even, horrible to say, everything," repeated Barzarov with indescribable composure. As the backstory goes, in 1957, one Joseph Franklin, 38, a comparative lit professor at Princeton, is preparing a lecture on existentialism, and he starts working his way through Fyodor Mikhailovich Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. As anyone who's read it can confirm, Notes, 1864, is a powerful but extremely weird little novel, and both these qualities have to do with the fact that the book is at once universal and particular. Its protagonist self-diagnosed disease, a blend of grandiosity and self-contempt, of rage and of cowardice, of ideological fervor and a self-conscious inability to act on his convictions, his whole paradoxical and self-negating character makes him a universal figure in whom we can see all parts of ourselves, the same kind of Aegis, a literary archetype, as Ajax or Hamlet. But at the same time, Notes from Underground and its underground man are impossible really to understand without some knowledge of the intellectual climate in Russia in the 1860s, particularly the frisson of utopian socialism and aesthetic utilitarianism then in vogue among the radical intelligentsia, an ideology that Dostoevsky loathed with a sort of passion that only Dostoevsky could loathe with. Anyway, Professor Frank, as he's wading through some of his particular context background so that he can give the students a comprehensive reading of the notes, begins to get interested in using Dostoevsky's fiction as a kind of bridge between two distinct ways of interpreting literature, a purely formal aesthetic approach versus a social-ideological criticism that cares only about thematics and the philosophical assumptions behind them. Footnote. Of course, contemporary literary theory is all about showing that there's no real distinction between these two ways to read, or rather it's about showing that aesthetics can pretty much always be reduced to ideology. For me, one reason Frank's overall project is so worthwhile is that it shows a whole different way to marry formal and ideological readings, an approach that isn't nearly as abstruse and sometimes reductive and all too often joy-killing as literary theory. I've lost myself. Where is the end of the footnote? This happens when you read footnotes and publish. Yes, here we go. That interest, plus 40 years of scholarly labor, has yielded the first four volumes of a projected five-book study of Dostoevsky's life, Life and Times in Writing. All the volumes are published by Princeton University Press. All four are titled Dostoevsky and then have subtitles, The Seeds of Revolt, The Years of Ordeal, The Stir of Liberation, and this year, an incredibly expensive hardcover, The Miraculous Years. Professor Frank must now be about 75, and judging by his photo in the Miraculous Years book jacket, he's not exactly hale. Footnote. The amount of library time you must have put in would take the stuffing out of anybody, I'd imagine. And probably all serious scholars of Dostoevsky are waiting baited to see whether Frank can hang on long enough to bring his encyclopedic study all the way up to the early 1880s, when Dostoevsky finished the fourth of his great novels. Footnote. Among the striking parallels with Shakespeare is the fact that FMD had four works of his mature period that are considered total masterpieces. The Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, Demons, a.k.a. The Demons, a.k.a. The Devils, a.k.a. The Possessed, and The Brothers Karamazov, all four of which involve murders and are, arguably, tragedies. Gave his famous Twitchian speech back in the main text and died. Even if the fifth volume of Dostoevsky doesn't get written, though, the appearance now of a fourth ensures Frank's status as the definitive literary biographer of one of the best fiction writers ever. Am I a good person? Deep down, do I even really want to be a good person, or do I only want to seem like a good person so that people, including myself, will approve of me? Is there a difference? How do I ever actually know whether I'm bullshitting myself, morally speaking? In a way, Frank's books aren't really literary biographies at all, at least not in the way that Ellman's books on Joyce and Bates's on Keats are. For one thing, Frank is as much a cultural historian as he is a biographer. His aim is to create an accurate and exhaustive context for FMD's works, to place the author's life and writing within a coherent account of 19th century Russia's intellectual life. Ellman's James Joyce, pretty much the standard by which most literary biographies are measured, doesn't go into anything like Frank's detail on ideology or politics or social theory. What Frank is about is showing that a comprehensive reading of Dostoevsky's fiction is impossible without a detailed understanding of the cultural circumstances in which the books were conceived and to which they were meant to contribute. This, Frank argues, is because Dostoevsky's mature works are fundamentally ideological and cannot truly be appreciated unless one understands the polemical agendas that inform them. In other words, the admixture of universal and particular that characterizes Notes from Underground really marks all the best of FMD, a writer whose evident desire, Frank says, is, quote, to dramatize his moral, spiritual themes against the background of Russian history. Another non-standard feature of Frank's biography is the amount of critical attention he devotes to the actual books Dostoevsky wrote. Quote, it is production of all such masterpieces that makes Dostoevsky's life worth recounting at all, his preface to The Miraculous Years goes. And my purpose, as in the previous volumes, is to keep them constantly in the foreground rather than treating them as accessory to the life per se. At least a third of this latest volume is given over to close readings of the stuff Dostoevsky produced in the amazing half-decade, Crime and Punishment, The Gambler, The Idiot, The Eternal Husband, and Demons. The readings aim to be explicative rather than argumentative or theory-driven. Their aim is to show as clearly as possible what Dostoevsky himself wanted the books to mean, even though this approach assumes there's no such thing as the intentional fallacy. Footnote. Never once in four nut volumes has Professor Frank mentioned the intentional fallacy. Sub-footnote. In case it's been a long time since Freshman Lent, the intentional fallacy, the judging of the meaning or success of a work of art by the author's expressed or sensible intention of producing it, the IF and the effective fallacy, the judging of a work of art in terms of its results, especially its emotional effect, are the big two prohibitions of objective type textual criticism, especially new criticism. Or try to head off the objection that his biography commits it all over the place. In a way, this silence is understandable, since the tone that Frank maintains through all of his readings is one of maximum restraint and objectivity. He's not about imposing any particular theory or method of decoding Dostoevsky, and he steers clear of fighting with critics who've chosen to apply the various axe's edges to FMD's work. When Frank does want to question or criticize a certain reading, he always does so simply by pointing out that the historical record and or Dostoevsky's own notes and letters contradict certain assumptions the critic has made. His argument is never that somebody else is wrong, just that they don't have all the facts. What's also interesting here is that Joseph Frank came of age as a scholar at just the time when the new criticism was becoming entrenched in the US Academy, and the good old intentional fallacy is pretty much a cornerstone of new criticism. And so, in Frank's not merely rejecting or arguing against the IF, but proceeding as if it didn't even exist, which is in italics, it's tempting to imagine all kinds of marvelous patricidal currents swirling around this project, Frank giving an enormous silent raspberry to his old teachers. But if you remember that new criticism removal of the author from the interpretive equation does as much as anything to clear the way for post-structural literary theory, as in e.g. deconstruction, Lacanian psychoanalysis, Marxist feminist cultural studies, Foucauldian, Greenblattian, new historians, historicism, etc., and that literary theory tends to do to the text itself what new criticism had done to the author of the text, then it starts to look as if Joseph Frank is taking a sharp early turn away from theory. Sub-footnote. Said theory being our own age's big radical intellectual fad, while there's nihilism and rational egotism were fads for FMD's Russia. And trying to compose a system of reading and interpretation so utterly different that it, Frank's approach, seems a more telling assault on lit theory's premises than any frontal attack could be. What exactly does faith mean? As in religious faith, faith in God, etc. Isn't it basically crazy to believe in something that there's no proof of? Is there really any difference between what we call faith and some primitive tribes sacrificing virgins to volcanoes because they believe it'll produce good weather? How can somebody have faith before he's presented with sufficient reason to have faith? Or is it somehow needing to have faith a sufficient reason for having faith? But then what kind of need are we talking about? Biographically speaking, what Frank's trying to do is ambitious and worthwhile. At the same time, his four volumes constitute a very detailed and demanding work on a very complex and difficult author, a fiction writer whose time and culture are alien to us. It seems hard to expect much credibility in recommending Frank's study here, unless I can give some sort of argument for why Dostoevsky's novels ought to be important to us as readers in 1996 America. And this is the interesting bit for me. This I can only do crudely because I'm not a literary critic or Dostoevsky expert. I am, though, a living American who both tries to write fiction and likes to read it. And thanks to Joseph Frank, I've spent pretty much the whole last 2 months immersed in Dostoevsky-nalia. Dostoevsky is a literary titan, and in some ways this can be a kiss of death, because it becomes easy to regard him as yet another sepia-tinted, capital C, canonical, capital A, author, belovedly dead. His works in the tall hill of criticism they've inspired are all required acquisition for college libraries, and there the books usually sit, yellowy, smelling the way really old library books smell, waiting for someone to have to do a term paper. Dahlberg is mostly right, I think. To make someone an icon is to make him an abstraction, and abstractions are incapable of vital communication with living people. But if I decide to decide there's a different, less selfish, less lonely point to my life, won't the reason for this decision be my desire to be less lonely, meaning to suffer less overall pain? Can the decision to be less selfish ever be anything other than a selfish decision? And it's true that there are features of Dostoevsky's books that are alien and off-putting. Russian is notoriously hard to translate into English, and when you add to this the difficulty of archaisms and 19th century literary heritage, Dostoevsky's prose dialogue can often come off-mannered and pleonistic and silly. Plus, there's the stiltedness of the culture Dostoevsky's characters inhabit. When people are ticked off, for instance, they do things like, quote, shake their fists, or call each other scoundrels, or fly at each other. Footnote. What on earth does it mean to fly at somebody? It happens dozens of times in every FMD novel. What? Fly at them in order to do what? To yell at them? Why not say that if you're translating? Speakers use explanation points and quantities now only seen in comic strips. Social etiquette always seems stiff to the point of absurdity. People are always calling on each other and either being received or not being received, and obeying Rococo conventions of politeness even when they're enraged. Everybody's got a long and hard to pronounce last name and a Christian name, plus a patronymic, plus sometimes a diminutive, so you almost have to keep a chart of characters' names. Obscure military ranks and bureaucratic hierarchies abound, plus there are rigid and totally weird class distinctions that are hard to keep straight and understand the implication of, especially because the economic realities of old Russian society are so strange, as in, e.g., the way even a destitute former student like Raskolnikov or an unemployed bureaucrat like the underground man can somehow afford to have servants. The point is that it's not just a death by canonization thing. There's a real and alienating stuff that stands in the way of our appreciating Dostoevsky that has to be dealt with, either by learning enough about all the unfamiliar stuff that it stops being so confusing, or else by accepting it, the same way we accept racist, sexist elements in some other 19th century books, and just grimacing and reading on anyway. But the larger point, which, yes, is kind of obvious, is that some art is worth the extra work of getting past all the impediments to its appreciation. And Dostoevsky's books are definitely worth the work. And this is not so just because of his bestriding the Western canon. If anything, it's despite that. For one thing that canonization and course assignments obscure is that Dostoevsky isn't just great, he's also fun. His novels almost always have ripping good plots, lurid and intricate and thoroughly dramatic. Their murders and attempted murders and police and dysfunction of family feuding and spies and tough guys and beautiful fallen women and unctuous con men and wasting illnesses and sudden inheritances and silky villains and scheming and whores. Of course, the fact that Dostoevsky can tell a juicy story isn't enough to make him great. If it were, Judith Krantz and John Grisham would be great fiction writers, and by any but the most commercial standards, they're not even very good. The main thing that keeps Krantz and Grisham and a lot of other gifted storytellers from being artistically good is that they don't have any talent for or interest in characterization. The thing about Dostoevsky's characters is that they are alive, by which I don't just mean they're successfully realized or developed or rounded, quote-unquote. The best of them live inside of us forever once we've met them. We're called the proud and pathetic Raskolnikov, the naive Devushkin, the beautiful and damned Nastasya, the idiot, the fawning Lebedev and Spider-ish Ippolit of the same novel, CMP's ingenious maverick detective Porfiry Petrovich, without whom there would probably be no commercial crime fiction with eccentrically brilliant cops, Marmeladov, the hideous and pitiful sot, or the vain and noble roulette addict Alexei Ivanovich of the Gambler, the gold-hearted prostitute Sonya and Liza, the cynically innocent Agalia, the unbelievably repellent Smirnikov, that living engine of the slimy resentment in whom I personally see parts of myself I can barely stand to look at, the idealized and all too human Mishkin and Aloysia, the do-human Christ and triumphant child pilgrim, respectively. The thrust here is that Dostoevsky wrote fiction about the stuff that's really important. He wrote fiction about identity, moral value, death, will, sexual versus spiritual love, greed, freedom, obsession, reason, faith, and suicide. And he did it without ever reducing his characters to mouthpieces or his books to tracks. His concern was always what it is to be a human being. That is, how to be an actual person, someone whose life is informed by values and principles instead of just an especially shrewd kind of self-preserving animal. Does this guy Jesus Christ's life have something to teach me, even if I don't or can't believe he was divine? What am I supposed to make of the claim that someone who was God's relative, and so could have turned the cross into a planter or something with just a word, still voluntarily let them nail him up there and died? Even if we suppose he was divine, did he know? Did he know he could have broken the cross with just a word? Did he know in advance of that death that it would just be temporary? Because I bet I could climb up there too if I knew that an eternity of right-hand bliss lay on the other side of 6 hours of pain. But does any of that even really matter? Can I still believe in JC or Muhammad or whoever, even if I don't believe they are actual relatives of God? Except, what would that mean, to believe in? The big thing that makes Dostoevsky invaluable for American readers and writers is that he appears to possess degrees of passion, conviction, and engagement with deep moral issues that we here, today, cannot or do not permit ourselves. Joseph Frank does an admirable job of tracing out the interplay of factors that make this engagement possible. FMD's own beliefs and talents, the ideological and aesthetic climates of his day, etc. Upon finishing Frank's books, though, I think that any serious American reader or writer will find himself driven to think hard about what exactly it is that makes many novelists of our own place and time look so thematically shallow and lightweight, so morally impoverished in comparison to Gogol or Dostoevsky, or even to lesser lights like Lermontov and Turgenev. Frank's bio prompts us to ask ourselves why we seem to require of our art an ironic distance from deep convictions or desperate questions, so that contemporary writers either have to make jokes of them, or else to try to work them in undercover some formal trick, like intertextual quotation or incongruous juxtaposition, sticking in really urgent stuff inside asterisks as part of some multivariant defamiliarization flourish or some such shit. All the sort of questions about self are in this essay inside of asterisks. So. Part of the explanation for Lit's thematic poverty obviously includes our century and situation. The good old modernists, among their other accomplishments, elevated aesthetics to the level of ethics, maybe even metaphysics. And serious novels, capital S, capital N, after Joyce, tend to be valued and studied mainly for their formal ingenuity. Such is the modernist legacy that we now presume as a matter of course that serious literature will be aesthetically distanced from real lived life. Add to this the requirement of textual self-consciousness imposed by postmodernism, footnote, whatever exactly that is, and literary theory, and it's probably fair to say that Dostoevsky et al. Were free of certain cultural expectations that severely constrain our own novelist's ability to be serious. But it's just as fair to observe, with Frank, that Dostoevsky operated under cultural constraints of his own, a repressive government, state censorship, and especially the popularity of post-Enlightenment European thought, much of which went directly against beliefs he held dear and wanted to write about. For me, the really striking, inspiring thing about Dostoevsky isn't just that he was a genius, he was also brave. He never stopped worrying about his literary reputation, but he also never stopped promulgating unfashionable stuff in which he believed. And he did this not by ignoring, now aka transcending or subverting, the unfriendly cultural circumstances in which he was writing, but by confronting them, engaging them, specifically, and by name. Have a cumulative look at just one snippet from Ippolit's famous Necessary Explanation in The Idiot. Long quotation. Anyone who attacks individual charity, I began, attacks human nature and casts contempt on personal dignity. The organization of public charity and the problem of individual freedom are two distinct questions and not mutually exclusive. Individual kindness will always remain because it is an individual impulse, a living impulse of one personality to exert a direct influence upon another. How can you tell, Barmatov, what significance such an association of one personality with another may have on the destiny of those associated? Can you imagine any of our own major novelists allowing a character to say stuff like this? Not, mind you, just as hypocritical bombast, so that the same ironic hero can stick a pin in it, but as part of a 10-page monologue by somebody trying to decide whether to commit suicide. The reason you can't is the reason he wouldn't. Such a novelist would be, by our lights, pretentious and overwrought and silly. The straight presentation of such a speech in a capital S, capital N serious novel today would provoke not outrage or invective, but worse, one raised eyebrow and a very cool smile. Maybe, if the novelist was really major, a dry bit of mockery in The New Yorker. The novelist would be, and this is our own age's truest vision of hell, laughed out of town. Last paragraph. So we, fiction writers, won't or can't dare try to use serious art to advance ideologies. Footnote. We will, of course, without hesitation, use art to parody, to ridicule, to debunk, to criticize ideologies. This is very different. The project would be like Menard's Quixote. People would either laugh or be embarrassed for us. Given this, and it is a given, who is to blame for the unseriousness of our serious fiction? The culture? The laughers? But they wouldn't, could not laugh if a piece of morally passionate, passionately moral fiction was also ingenious and radiantly human fiction. But how to make it that? How, for a writer today, even a talented writer today, to get up the guts to even try? There are no formulas or guarantees. There are, however, models. Frank's books make one of them concrete and alive and terribly instructive.